Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour from London. Here's what's coming up.
As the battle against coronavirus ramps up around the world, former US Surgeon General Boris Lushniak warns mistakes now could have dire consequences later. And with the global economy hit hard by this pandemic, there are companies filling the void, doing well while doing good. I speak with Amazon Senior Vice President Jay Carney. Then,
think about ways you can help with medical supplies, contact your cities, make partnerships, give your capabilities to your local officials.
One college president adopts an all-school mobilization for this fight. R. Walter Isaacson with Tufts University President Anthony Monaco.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The World Health Organization is now warning that the coronavirus pandemic is accelerating and that the United States could be the next epicenter, with New York in the eye of this storm. There are nearly 400,000 cases globally now and almost 20,000 deaths. As Congress wrestles with a massive emergency bill, President Trump is hinting that he may soon order businesses to reopen, despite dire warnings from his public health team. Here in Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has now announced the strictest lockdown since World War II, including banning public gatherings of more than two people and closing all shops that sell non-essential goods. And now India, a country of 1.3 billion people, is also on total lockdown for a minimum of 21 days. That is a third of the world's population on some kind of lockdown. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, together with the International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach, has finally agreed to postpone the Summer Games until 2021.
I proposed, Mr. Bach, to postpone the event for about a year. Mr. Bach said that he will 100% agree.
Meanwhile, there is a glimmer of hope in China, where officials say locally transmitted cases have dropped to near zero over this past week. Now, we'll look at all of this over the next hour, but first we want to turn to Dr. Boris Lushniak. He's the former acting Surgeon General of the United States. He served as head of the U.S. medical team fighting Ebola in Monrovia back in 2015. That was in Liberia. Dr. Lushniak, welcome to the program.
Great. Happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
So you are a full-blown medical expert and you have tackled, you know, an epidemic before. I want to know what you make of now the dire warnings coming out of the World Health Organization following some very, very dire warnings from the New York State governor that the United States could be the next epicenter. What does that mean to you? What does that look like?
Well, it's actually a matter of high concern, obviously, here in the United States and specifically at the University of Maryland, where I'm now the dean of the School of Public Health. When I look at this, we certainly see what's been happening across the world. You know, first, it was December, January in China, and we were all bracing to kind of see where this was going to spread. Obviously, spread to other parts of Asia, then ended up in Italy, then started spreading to other parts of Europe, and now is entering North America and the United States in particular. It is a full-blown pandemic, and this is what we were dreading on the one hand, but also somewhat expecting when we knew about this disease coming on.
Now, we hear from New York that they expect the peak to be in about 14 days, and the governor is asking for federal stockpiles of ventilators at the very least to be released to his most hardest hit state, apparently 10 times more cases there than anywhere else in the United States. The U.S. and the U.K., where I am, are considered to have been late in responding and following the example of other countries that started to get hit before. Do you agree that they were late, and what are the consequences?
Well, I think we're late on several aspects, one of which is specifically here in the United States, the issue of the testing, the diagnostics really was late. So right now, we're already behind the curve. So even the incredible numbers and the tragic numbers we're seeing up in New York State really are not a reflection of current times, but in essence, anywhere between 5 to 10 days ago, right, in terms of people getting the coronavirus disease. So right now we are bracing for even more worse numbers coming on this week as testing and the diagnostics are more readily available. We're going to be testing more individuals, which means the numbers are going to shoot up.
So you're talking about testing. I mean, that's one of the things that everybody's been, you know, screaming for. They want the test. You're sure that there are enough testing kits and facilities to do this?
No, not within the United States. I mean, we've been promised an increase of these testing, the testing equipment, the reagents to be made available. They are greater than they were the day before, but not as many as we need. Mm-hmm. Certainly, even the protocols regarding testing are changing. It really happened in terms of an expansion of testing from being at the federal level, that is within the CDC, to now expanding to sort of an all-hands-on-deck approach, including private industry being involved in this. But at the same time, we are definitely under-testing, and that's one of the things that are really now making us quite a bit behind on. The other aspect, as you talked about being behind on, is the surge capabilities of our medical care system. We are now bracing for what we're seeing in Italy, which is an influx of patients coming into emergency rooms, coming into the hospitals, and in essence, now taxing the medical care system within the United States. That is another thing that's ahead of us, I fear.
Mm-hmm. So into this, President Trump, who's been holding a town hall and who said anyway over the last 24 or so hours that, to paraphrase, he doesn't want the cure to be worse than the actual problem, than the disease. So he's saying, you know, by Easter, he would want to see the economy up and running again and people, where they can, going back to work. I would just like to play a little soundbite and then we'll talk about this.
I'm not looking at months, I can tell you right now. We're going to be opening up our country. You can't keep it closed for the next, for years. Okay, this is going away. You can't do that with a country, especially the number one economy anywhere in the world, by far. Number one economy in the world, can't do that. Because, well, it causes bigger problems than the original. That's why I talk about the cure being worse than the problem.
So, you know, you have doctors standing next to her. You have all the experts, the really, really professionals in the United States, which is part of the White House team there with Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, and the others. I'm talking to you now, a former acting surgeon general. What is wrong with that statement or not?
Well, you know, it's that whole idea of two different forms of communication taking place simultaneously on the same stage. And that's one of the major problems with communication here in the United States, is they really shouldn't be taking place on the same stage. The president is future framed, right? Future oriented. He's open ended. He's noncommittal and he offers suggestions, right? He speculates about matters. Around him are the public health experts. Their time frame is immediate, right? They talk about the risk to health, about protective measures, about the epidemiology, about data and confirmed facts. And I think what we're seeing when we see these press conferences occur is both those scenarios meshing. And it, in fact, leads to a problem, which creates confusion, right? In reality, what do we know about the time frame? I can only look back in time, right? This is a brand new virus. We've never seen it as humankind. So this is a very unique situation. And I can only learn about what I've seen in the past. And what I've seen in the past is what has gone on in China. As you mentioned earlier, the time frame roughly is 12 weeks or so since the first case to now, right? And what we're seeing is the beginning of a downturn in China. So when I look at reality, right, I look at measures that need to be taken. At best, I'm thinking about 12 weeks in the United States and perhaps throughout different countries after the moment that they get their first cases until we have the beginning of a downturn. Now, the beginning of a downturn is not the end of the problem. In fact, at the downturn point, we actually at times have to be more vigilant. It'll be interesting to see what happens in China as they loosen up some of their restrictions in terms of travel to see whether we get another bump in terms of the number of individuals involved in COVID-19.
Very quickly, about this timetable that the president seems to be saying, 15 days. I mean, that's practically Easter, as he's just said again today. But how can you do that if you don't have what you've just said, and that's testing? I mean, surely the only way to release people back into the environment, so to speak, is to know that they're clear.
Right. I mean, in essence, we have to, again, look at what we know about COVID-19. So first of all, the majority of cases, and this needs to be stressed, the majority of cases are still mild cases. 80% or so can actually have the infection, have some symptoms, may still be fully functioning in the home, away from people, we hope, but in essence, not severely ill. What we're really looking at now are the 20% or so, looking at the data that came in initially from China, of the individuals who have to, for example, be hospitalized. And so therefore, what we're really seeing here is that in a 15-day time frame, right, it's a matter of not only giving an all clear during that time frame, but in essence, making sure that those 20% are taken care of appropriately, and ultimately that they do have a sense of resolution of their infection. And for the 80% who are sitting at home and self-convalescing, if you will, who therefore don't come out in public too early before their cases are resolved. And in essence, you absolutely hit the nail on the head. Testing is going to be a key component of this for me to know as a physician, when is there an all clear for a specific patient? Now, develop a whole population model for that. And in essence is you really have to rely on testing to a large extent.
So I want to take two different issues in around the world. So Argentina, we're getting reports that, you know, they have instituted some very, you know, significant lockdowns, even though they don't have many cases. And they have noticed a little bit of a drop in cases since these lockdowns. So they've really got out perhaps ahead of it because it hasn't struck Latin America the way it has struck the Northern Hemisphere. On the other hand, here, before the announcement in Britain of a total lockdown, which came overnight, there was a week ago the idea that we could have this herd immunity, that somehow, even without vaccinating a population, they could somehow let this virus play itself out and immunize the herd, so to speak. Was that smart to do that from a medical perspective?
Well, again, oftentimes that term herd immunity is utilized when we talk about immunizations, right? It's the reaction of people who are getting vaccinated, right, who get the immunizations, and the reaction of making sure their immune systems are able to fight future diseases. And so therefore, we protect people, we protect the herd by making sure a certain percent of individuals are in fact immunized. What we don't know, and again, it goes back to this very unique in time and place regarding a brand new virus that we've never seen before, is really what is the immunity that develops from COVID-19? You know, we're getting some basic information, but in essence, right now, I don't even know when the antibodies are forming, right? Are they potentially protecting me from a second recurrence of the disease? How long is that last in terms of that immunity, if in fact it does exist? And so when we look at the coronaviruses, there's various sort of models out there of kind of saying, well, you know, as you know, coronaviruses, some of them cause the common cold. Well, we know we don't have lifelong immunity to the common cold. We may have a short-term immunity. So relying on immunity alone as a public health measure is not the correct approach. You really have to rely on these other measures, which in essence, I realize, are very 19th or 20th century in their models. People now expect that we have the pills that we can give out, that we have the vaccines available. But in essence, we're going back to 1918, 1919, the Spanish flu, and the recommendations from public health, which is, in essence, stay away from each other. Mm-hmm. It's transmitted from me to you. If I'm, in fact, a carrier, you can get it, provided that we're close to each other and provided that I'm not taking these other public health measures into consideration. So we have to keep people apart at this early stage.
And Dr. Lushniak, I wonder what you make of this other information that's coming out of Italy. So at the beginning, the World Health Organization measured the number of deaths there versus the number of confirmed cases. Now, Italian officials, the Civil Protection Agency, is saying there could be 10 times the number of infections just with people not showing symptoms or not having been tested, etc., which would bring the death rate down to 0.9% as opposed to 9%. Just
right.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, it's early on in this brand new pandemic for us. So the initial numbers that come out with any brand new disease, any epidemic, is what we would call a crude case fatality rate. And so the number crude or the term crude is critical here. That means it's an estimate. The best I can do is to say, and this is simple math, there's a numerator, which is how many people have died as a result of the disease. Always questionable, am I actually diagnosing those individuals and their cause of death is in fact accurate, over the number of people with the disease who have been diagnosed. What we see here is obviously a very crude rate, right? It's a simple number that WHO has been putting out, the Chinese have been putting up, which is, here's how many people we think have died of the disease, here's how many people we think have had it. You're absolutely right. It goes back to some of our testing dilemmas, right, here in the United States, is the bottom number, the denominator, right, which includes everybody with the disease. If I have a whole lot of people who, for example, are asymptomatic or have mild symptoms and aren't tested, well, that number will shoot up, in which case, if I'm confident that my number of deaths are accurate, is going to bring down this case fatality rate. Oftentimes, we don't get an accurate case fatality rate until after an epidemic is over.
It's extraordinary. So interesting and so urgent, all of this. Dr. Lushniak, thank you so much for joining us. And I just want to repeat what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of the United States has said, that the United States may not get through this virus crisis until probably late May, June, or maybe even July. Could even be as late as July. Meantime, talking about Italy and being the hardest hit for a long time now in Europe, one small town in the north did eradicate coronavirus in under 14 days by, as we've just been talking, testing all 3,000 residents and quarantining them effectively. This approach, unfortunately, is not happening in many countries where the spread of this pandemic is still rising and healthcare professionals across Europe continue to work around the clock to keep people safe. Isa Suarez, along with other correspondents, looks at the toll this sacrifice is having on their health.
We've had doctors tell us that they feel like lambs to the slaughter, that they feel like cannon fodder.
Across Europe, doctors and nurses are on the front lines battling the coronavirus, and a worrying statistic is emerging: the number of medical workers themselves who have become infected. In China, just under 4% of the cases reported through February 11th were healthcare workers. In Spain, it's over 10%, and Italy is not far behind. Here in the UK, medical workers are begging for cooperation from the general public.
We need to stay healthy so we can help you. You can help save our lives. Stay at home.
Nearly 4,000 National Health Service workers penned an article expressing concern that they don't have adequate protection. The NHS says it's stepping up deliveries of vital supplies. But it is in Italy where the crisis has been most acute.
Here in Italy, coronavirus first took hold in Europe. Many in the medical community were caught off guard by just how quickly and tenaciously the virus took hold.
More than 20 Italian doctors have now died. Among them was Dr. Roberto Stella.
Roberto Stella was a friend of mine. Roberto Stella was a great enthusiastic doctor.
Michele Leone says he hopes his friend is remembered as someone who gave back, who started a program for high school students to learn about medicine. Dr. Angelo Pan is the head of infectious disease medicine at a hospital in Cremona.
Even a small error can give you the infection, and then you have to hope not to get any serious problem. It is quite scary, yes.
Dr. Pan says his hospital is well supplied. The pandemic came so quickly, though, that he did not have time to train his colleagues in infectious protocols. Patients are now being treated throughout the hospital.
And now I'm taking care of the patients in the orthopedic wards. They are not used to manage patients that have transmittable viral infections. I'm scared of the outbreak. I hope I will not die before the outbreak ends up.
The crisis hit Spain later than Italy, but the number of cases here has skyrocketed. One of the big problems we're seeing at hospitals like this one is a lack of protective equipment.
The nursing union has even created an instructional video on how to fashion a waterproof gown out of garbage bags. She explains how to fold and tape the bag just so that it provides protection and fits.
Do you feel safe at work?
No, del todo.
No, we don't feel completely safe, he says. You don't stop to think about it, or we wouldn't go in to see the patients, but we have to.
A lack of personal protective equipment is also a serious problem here in France, where the government's introduced some of the most stringent quarantine protocols in Europe. The first French doctor died this past weekend. Already now, at least four medical workers have died. I spoke with a lawyer who represents doctors suing the French government over the lack of equipment and masks in particular. French authorities have now ordered 250 million of them, but one of the doctors suing the government says it is far too late. He says authorities here are guilty of incompetence. The French government tells CNN they have no comment on the lawsuit.
If this virus had arrived in France, then okay, we would have been unprepared. We wouldn't know how it works. But we watched China for 3 months and Italy for 15 days. How could they have thought it was going to be different here? And the proof is that today we have exactly the same figures in terms of mortality.
As the number of cases in Europe continue to spike, it is these doctors and nurses who are selflessly putting their health as well as their lives on the line so that we can survive. Isa Suarez, London.
And now back in the United States, in his press conference today, the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said the state has 10 times the number of coronavirus cases as California, which is the next worst hit. And he laid out one of the most critical challenges to the American supply chain, the massive demand for ventilators, highly specialized medical technology that means the difference between life and death for so many thousands.
This is a dramatic increase in the number of ventilators that you need. We have been working around the clock, scouring the globe. We've procured about 7,000 ventilators. We need, at a minimum, an additional 30,000 ventilators. You cannot buy them. You cannot find them.
Now Governor Cuomo is calling on federal stockpiles to be released to his worst-hit state before the expected peak there in 14 days. Now, despite or perhaps because of the logistical challenges facing the economy now, one American company is thriving. Amazon is raising wages and bringing on 100,000 new employees. Jay Carney is the Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs there, and he's former Press Secretary to the Obama White House, joining me now from Washington. Jay Carney, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Christiane.
I mean, you know, yes, you are filling in where so many parts of the economy can't reach. But I just want to ask you, because clearly your deliveries and demand is so far up, are you transporting some of what the governor said that he needs, like ventilators and things? I mean, is there any of that being transported and delivered by Amazon now?
Well, we are absolutely working with both state and local officials, as well as the federal government here in the United States, on getting medical supplies, household goods, and other things to the customers and patients who need it most. An example that we've seen is with masks that are in such high demand right now and almost impossible to get. We, you wouldn't be surprised to know, have put in purchase orders for many, many masks for our employees as well as our customers. And most of those masks are being repurposed to healthcare workers rather than coming through our system. Once they do begin to come through our system, we'll get them to our customers and our employees as soon as we can. We're also working in Washington State, our headquarters in Seattle, with local authorities there and with the Gates Foundation to get delivery of home testing kits to potential COVID-19 sufferers. And we're learning as we go, Christiane. Like everyone, we're having daily meetings of our leadership to brainstorm about what else we can do to protect our customers so that they can deliver the goods that our protect our employees so they can deliver the goods that our customers need, ways that we can help with the WHO, the CDC, with the administration here in Washington, as well as with governments elsewhere around the world where we do business.
So, I mean, you brought up protecting your employees. And as you know, it's obviously difficult to do that. Everybody is exposed. So a number of employees have complained that there's not enough health protections in place. A number have complained that there have been outbreaks of infections in various Amazon locations, and yet they're not closed. And as you obviously know, because you work in this area, you have four U.S. senators who've written to the boss, Jeff Bezos, about their concern. Let me just read it. We are concerned by reports that managers at Amazon's warehouses continue to hold stand-up staff meetings before every shift, meetings that result in dozens of staff crowded together in rooms. We're also concerned by reports that hand sanitizer, disinfectant wipes are in short supply at Amazon warehouses, and that some Amazon warehouses are not receiving additional cleaning. Perhaps most concerned with Amazon's stringent use of rate-based write-ups, which are currently preventing warehouse employees from practicing good sanitary habits. Answer that, obviously, because these are on the front lines, these employees. Sure.
Well, they are. And I just have to say the letter is disappointing because there's almost no truth to some of the accusations they made. We have gone to extreme measures to ensure that our facilities where our fulfillment centers employees are working are cleaned regularly, deep cleaned regularly. We've instituted practices to prevent congregation. We're supplying everyone with wipes and hand sanitizer. We have the challenge that I mentioned earlier of acquiring masks, but we are working diligently to get as many masks as we can, while, of course, prioritizing delivery to healthcare workers. So I think we are doing extraordinary things. Amazon workers around the country and the world are doing extraordinary things to ensure the safety of our employees while delivering essential goods to millions and millions of people around the world, including household staples, including medical supplies, toiletries and the like that otherwise are very hard to come by because some people are ordered by governments to shelter in place, mm-hmm. to stay at home, and they rely very heavily on a delivery service like Amazon to get what they need.
And what about, we just said that you're employing 100,000 new employees. I mean, clearly there's a massive demand as the rest of the retail sector, grinds to a halt. What about price gouging? We've heard all sorts of, stories of unscrupulous people gouging prices. I think you've taken steps to counter that.
We have. We're absolutely concerned about this, and any price gouging is intolerable. As you know, Christian, our Amazon stores are not just our own inventory, but represent goods sold by third-party sellers. In most cases, well above 55% of what you see is from third-party sellers. And when we catch a third-party seller price gouging, we suspend that seller's account. We've suspended over or nearly 3,900 accounts in the United States alone when we've caught price gouging. And we're working with law enforcement officials, state attorneys general, as well as with the United States Justice Department, to refer cases of price gouging, the most egregious cases, for prosecution.
Let me just ask you another question about public health, because apparently there's an article in The Lancet, the medical journal, which found that this virus, COVID-19, can actually linger on cardboard for 24 hours, up to 3 days on plastic and stainless steel. And of course, again, with millions of your packages going around the world, that potentially is a hazard. What can you do to limit that?
What I've been asked this before, and what I can say is that two things. One, there has yet to be a case, as far as I understand it, according to the WHO and the CDC, of transmission from a package of the COVID-19 virus. However, customers should take appropriate measures if they are concerned about the possible transmission of the virus. So they should wipe down with sanitizer the packages they receive if they feel that's necessary. They should perhaps place them in a separate room or separate area for a matter of time, based on the article that you've mentioned, to allow any lingering virus to die. We certainly would understand if customers were to do that, because like everyone, they are and we are taking every precaution we can based on the evidence we have.
So let me ask you about the slightly bigger picture, the stimulus bill. As you know, it's been under a lot of wrangling and Democrats concerned that the administration could have $100 billion or more dollars to use without accountability or to farm out where it might want to. Now, obviously, the Trump administration and Amazon have been in some tweet wars and conflicts with Trump and Jeff Bezos. And you lost out on a $10 billion contract with the Pentagon last year. And you've taken, the administration to court over it. That might be okay in normal times, but in these terrible emergency times, what are your biggest worries about the stimulus, about all this money that's being proposed?
Well, first and foremost, let me just say that notwithstanding some of the issues you mentioned, we are working very closely with the White House and other agencies within the American administration to do everything we can to provide services and data and technological know-how to help in the fight against COVID-19. So we've been engaged in conversations. Jeff Bezos, the CEO and founder of Amazon, was on a call with President Trump last week, where President Trump praised Amazon for our efforts to deliver services and products to millions and millions of Americans, and also over the fact that we're ramping up our hiring and raising our pay at a time when so many businesses are forced to shut their doors and lay workers off. So there's that. On the broader question, look, you are right. I'm a veteran of these kinds of battles. I think that we don't take a position at Amazon on which side is right in the current dispute over the stimulus package. We do think that urgent action is necessary to ensure that the right supplies get to our healthcare workers around the country and that the proper stimulus is provided to the economy.
Jay Carney, thank you so much. Vice President of Amazon, and like Amazon, streaming devices, Netflix, YouTube, and the other, they are actually doing quite well, the tech industry at the moment. So turning now to today's big sports news. After days and days of will they or won't they, the Summer Olympics have now been postponed until 2021. The International Olympic Committee had been facing mounting pressure to do this. For the very latest now, I'm joined by longtime IOC member Dick Pound from Montreal in Canada, and by the greatest marathon runner in the world, Eliud Kipchoge from Kenya, who was due to defend his Olympic marathon title this year. Let me start with you, Mr. Kipchoge, because what you do inspires so many, many people. And let us just remind everybody that you did do the record marathon in under two hours. Just tell me what this means to you that these games have been postponed.
It's actually disappointing, but, many athletes have been preparing. Personally, I've been preparing for a very long time to participate in Tokyo Olympics. But all in all is that I actually support what IOC and Japanese Federation have decided. First is that held fast, and I'm happy that they consider the held as number one priority as far as athletics is concerned and the whole sport.
And Eliud, this disease has not yet struck your continent, thank God, the way it's struck the Northern Hemisphere. It might do. But how are you adapting? How are you, your family, your community in Kenya dealing with this right now?
It's really hard. Our government actually is telling everybody to stay at home, to stay indoors. Personally, I'm posting some messages encouraging everybody to stay at home, avoid the big groups, and not actually mingle. Try to wash your hands every now and then, not to spit anyhow. But only know is that stay away and stay at home, actually to prevent this COVID-19.
Yeah. We'll be back to you in a moment about sports, but we're just showing that public service announcement that you're talking about. I'd like to move on quickly to Dick Pound. You are the coal face of all of this. What went into that decision? Was it the right decision?
I think it was the right decision. In fact, probably the only sensible decision in the circumstances. We didn't want to cancel the games, but we also were beginning to realize, on the basis of the information provided by the World Health Organization, that July 24th this year was just not going to be possible, and that we were going to have to think of postponement. The Japanese authorities came to roughly the same conclusion, and today the respective presidents of the government and the IOC agreed that there should be a postponement. The broad lines of that will have to be worked out, but most likely we're looking at a delay of about a year and having games in July, August of 2021.
Many people say this decision should have come much earlier. Do you think so? I mean, certainly Canada pretty much said, well, you can do what you want, but we're not sending our athletes. It was one of the first countries to say no.
Well, it actually wasn't, but I would say the Canadian decision and the ones that followed that were made easier by the fact that on Sunday, the IOC sent out two releases, one addressed generally to athletes and another to the general public, saying we don't favor cancellation. It doesn't look like it's going to be possible to stick to the original schedule. So that put postponement, in the fore. And I think at the time, the information from the World Health Organization showed a dangerously steep curve in the number of cases, and that it's just not going to be possible to contain this probably before the end of the year. And that the public health considerations for everybody, athletes, spectators, and everyone involved, were such that they had to take the first priority. I mean, this is a pandemic that has enormous tragic potential if it's not contained very quickly, and we didn't want to add to the problem.
And Eliud Kipchoge, what does it mean for you as a finely tuned machine? I mean, you guys have a massively full schedule all year of and year after year of different athletic events, and you have to train and you have to time yourself and you have to do it all according to a very precise schedule physiologically and psychologically, I guess, as well. Just tell me what it's like to have to adjust something so major as the Olympic Games.
It's really it destabilizes everything as far as sport is concerned. You know, we have been actually scheduled to run some of the marathons before Olympic Games, but all in all is that this thing COVID-19 has destabilized the whole world. The world is on a crossroad, and we need to accept. We need to actually support our leadership in the whole world health organization, UN, our governments, our athletics organizations, in order to beat this COVID-19. It's hard for other athletes who have been actually day and night training for the big games. I know most of the youth actually wants to show their careers to the whole world. Olympic Games is an important event whereby the important thing is to participate, and the second thing is to actually hunt for the medal. But only those say it's really very good games whereby you can actually put in your neck by saying that I participated in Olympics. But most careers has been shattered. Mm-hmm. But we need to accept it. It's the world. It affects all the world. It affects everybody. All walks of life, from economy, from all sorts of businesses, sports and everything. So I urge all my colleagues to actually accept, still train hard. Next year actually will come back in a big way, and all will be well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's very moving to hear you say so many careers may be shattered. I think that's what you said. Are you? I know you say you're urging your colleagues to keep training. Can you train? And what about the London Marathon, which has also been cancelled? And you have won it many, many times, and you are going to defend again.
It was unfortunate that London Marathon was pushed to 4th October later in the year, mm-hmm. and I and my heart athletes have been training very well to make sure that we run a good race in the streets of London. But all in all is that, in this world, anything might happen, and we need to accept and move on. We need to see the world as a good factor, and it will make us all move in a good way.
Mm-hmm. You're really well known for all the records you've broken, but that marathon that you did in under 2 hours really just, swept the world and swept everybody's imagination. How hard was that, not just to achieve, but to get ready to do it? Describe some of the extreme measures you went to. I think you practiced in very, very high altitude. Tell me how you trained to do that.
It was really hard. It took a lot of time to train, 5 to 6 months. But all in all is that they took a lot of energy mentally than even physically. Although I was really physically fit, but above all is that it took a lot of energy in my mind. And it was really a different race whereby I needed to actually run against the unthinkable. Yeah. Everybody in the world was actually skeptical that a human being can run under 2 hours. But all in all is that I trust what I've been doing. I trust the management. I trust the coaching. I trust everybody, the whole team surrounding me. And I tell them, let us go. And we manage it. And that's why I pass a very positive message to the whole world.
Yes, it did
even
indeed. And it's kind of like the Olympic spirit. Let me just finally turn to Dick Pound again. How difficult was it for Tokyo to just do this? Because they have invested so much. You know, they had it cancelled in 1940 because of the war. And, you know, Dick Pound, they have so much infrastructure, so much riding on it, so many actual, you know, buildings, the Olympic Village and everything. Take us behind the scenes of the calamity for Tokyo.
Well, they certainly have a huge investment in this project and have worked very diligently for the last decade on getting into position to do it. And I know they're immensely disappointed, but they too recognize the importance of public health and getting control of this COVID virus. So they were reluctant, of course, to concede having to postpone it, but also understand that that's the best decision. They appreciate the support from the IOC and the sports world to having a postponement and continuing with the games next year. And I think their prime minister said it right. This will be an opportunity for a complete Olympics coming out of a terrible, terrible pandemic. And it'll speak to the resilience of the human condition.
Well, there you go. All right. Dick Pound, Eliud Kipchoge, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And just again to mention, the first time the Olympics have been postponed, cancelled in peacetime. Across the globe, though, schools and universities have also been forced to shut. They are doing so to protect students and teachers and slow the spread of coronavirus. But could they play a vital role in the solution? Tufts University, just outside Boston, Massachusetts, has transformed parts of its campus into a military-style hospital. And students are also now using their skills to support the healthcare system. Anthony Monaco is president of Tufts, and he spoke to Walter Isaacson via Zoom.
President Tony Monaco, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Walter.
What are universities like yours doing in this crisis?
Walter, we have been having conversations with our hospitals about their needs, which are in several different areas. We've been able to help them now with lab supplies, masks, helping to repair old masks, sending ventilators from our veterinary hospital. In addition, they are very concerned about the beds availability, especially if there's a surge. And they have asked us to think about our campuses as alternative treatment centers, which could house emergency personnel, low-level patients that are inpatients currently that are having a bottleneck getting people out. We're looking at all kinds of possibilities. We have isolation units on campus because we had an outbreak, so we are organized to be able to isolate any cases that occur.
You've written an op-ed about additional steps that should be taken. Walk us through those, please.
Well, Walter, first, if you're going to change your campus into a military-style hospital, you have to have military logistics and communications advice. We were very lucky to have that at our Fletcher School, and those military fellows and faculty there have stepped up in the most amazing way, can-do attitude, giving us advice, not making decisions, relying on our expertise, and they've been helping, as I said, our hospitals and cities. Secondly, you need to inventory all your rooms for single-use bathroom isolation units, which ones are on the periphery, which ones are near parking lots. Third, think about the future as a testing center, as well as overrun facilities for hospitals. Testing is very important. Think about ways you can help with medical supplies, contact your cities, make partnerships, give your capabilities to your local officials in some kind of incident command center.
Would you be willing to allow patients to live in the dorms?
Absolutely. One of the things that has been found in China is 75 to 80% of transmission is through family units. If the case arises that a relatively mild case is in a family with an elderly, vulnerable person or immunosuppressed person, we could help isolate them if they have nowhere else to go. It's an effective intervention strategy, and we're willing to adopt it.
What about helping to do things like make masks? Are your students trying to pitch in, those who are still there?
Yes, Tufts Medical Center was given a donation of 6,000 N95 masks, but they're very old, and every time they put them on, the elastic broke. So we quickly organized some of our engineering students to work with MIT and Harvard students. They came up with a prototype, and they're already starting today to repair these masks, which really significantly increases the capacity of the medical center.
You're a distinguished geneticist. You helped discover the gene that causes some forms of muscular dystrophy. To what extent do you think genetic tools someday will be able to be the way we fight off viruses?
I don't think genetics in this particular case has got that much to do with it, that this is about vaccination and prevention and being ready the next time and being prepared. Right now, the only tools we have are testing and isolation. We need to focus on that, and we need to think about what's going to happen in 1 month's time when the hospitals are overrun, the alternative treatment centers are full. We need a scalable way to monitor fevers at a distance and get mobile units to those that are most vulnerable so we can help them and they don't require hospitalization.
So describe to me how you're setting up on the Tufts campus what is really a satellite medical center.
We've looked at our complete building stock and our dining halls, and we've gotten military logistics and communications help from our Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. They've been advising us, Tufts Medical Center, and our cities of Medford and Somerville, local to our campus. We've identified all units that have single-use bathrooms that can be used for isolation. We've identified units that could house nurses, healthcare workers, those that don't want to go back to their families if they're at increased risk and perhaps infect vulnerable members. We're going to take low-level medical patients that need things like wound care, post-operative PT, things that are not going to require a full hospital suite. That's in conversations, but we are preparing for that.
And are you working in collaboration with Harvard, MIT, and the hospital systems, which I think is probably the largest hospital systems per capita in the country in the Boston, Cambridge, Medford area?
Yes, they're all communicating at the hospital level, and we've been in communications at the university level. They're all reaching out to particularly their teaching-affiliated hospitals where they know each other well, and they're listening. What are your needs? How can we help?
You've had a student who tested positive. First of all, how is the student? How are the people?
The student is fully recovered. He did expose a large number of students. We traced them all. We isolated all of them in quarantine or wherever they were. And right now, they all seem to be fine. Just getting reports, but we haven't had a major outbreak within the student body, luckily.
Your international students, are they frustrated by having been given very little notice and having trouble to manage this crisis?
Of course they're disappointed, Walter. But then again, we've received multiple emails from their parents thanking us for allowing them to stay. So grateful that they were able to stay put, try to be safe, and not take that dangerous trip back to a level 3 country. So most of it has been about their needs currently on campus, but a lot of gratitude from parents that we were able to accommodate.
What have you done about poorer students for whom it'd be difficult to go home or maybe not even that safe to go home? Do you allow them to stay on campus?
If they have circumstances, which was reviewed by the Student Affairs Office that didn't have a home destination or those types of situations, yes. Some of those were permitted to stay. We do still have a lot of students living off campus in houses that are not owned by the university, and so we've been communicating with them as well. We have offered travel cost, anything we can do. There's been a very good fundraising effort through students to help, and we've organized that through our advancement office, and there are funds available and assistance when students need it.
Is there anything you did that you wish had been done slightly differently and other universities might learn from your mistake?
No, I'm sorry, not that I haven't made any mistakes, but when we found out that we had a COVID positive student, I made two phone calls. One was to get the health authority aware, follow their protocols for tracing, et cetera. The second was to former Allied Commander of NATO, Jim Stavridis, former Dean of the Fletcher School, asking him for military logistics help, which he pointed me to. That was an important step. So right from the beginning, we were not making missteps that we would regret when the number of patients that we're trying to help increases exponentially.
I'm teaching my class at Tulane through this method, through Zoom. It's something that we in the education industry have talked about for a decade, which is online classes. And we never really did quite as much as we thought we would. Do you think that this situation is going to help increase the use and blending in of online classes in universities?
Yes, out of the necessity of the situation, we are running all of our courses for the rest of the semester, many using Zoom and Canvas. It's a wonderful technology. I certainly appreciate how well it's going to be suited to our needs. I do think you're right that it's going to change how colleges and universities think in the future, and you know, the fall semester is at risk given how long this might last. And we're all planning that we have to consider at least continuing this type of distance learning. We hope not, but we are preparing.
Do you think we have to balance the need to isolate to control this disease versus the need of people who are students just to get on with their lives and get back to campus? Would you push back on a fall closure?
I think there's two needs here. Obviously, as an academic institution, our primary mission is to educate our students and to do so in this time of crisis. At the same time, this is a disaster of very large proportion. You've seen the scenes from Italy. It's going to happen here unless we organize ourselves to help the hospitals. I've said it before, this is a Dunkirk moment for our country, and if we don't get out the boats to get our hospitals across the channel, we're going to have a huge surge, which they can't manage, and we're not going to have anywhere for people to go. We're waiting for the governor to give us the signal. He knows our capacities. I can't believe I'm turning this beautiful campus into a military-style hospital, but that's what we need to do to help our hospitals when they get overrun, and it will happen.
What are you hearing from your students about what they need?
Our students are worried about a lot of things, getting the online working, reimbursements for the room and board that they're not using while they're here, worried about their friends, just the sudden change of all this and the sudden uprooting from friends, I think, was the most difficult thing for them. And those that have to self-isolate, it's lonely in self-isolation. We may be physically isolated, but we're not socially isolated. I hope people will reach out to their friends and help them through this using digital means.
Generations are sometimes shaped by things that happen when they're in college, whether it was the greatest generation that had to go off to World War II, or a Vietnam generation, or here in New Orleans, the Katrina generation, and people came back differently. Do you think this will somehow imprint on an entire generation of college students, a new way of looking at the world?
Well, Walter, this is really a war. This is the equivalent of any world war that we had with suffering that is going to be all over the news. And this generation is going to witness that. They're going to need a lot of help. There's increased mental health disorders in this generation in any case. So you can imagine how difficult it is going to be for them to watch the suffering that may happen live on television. I hope they get the help they need. We certainly will be there for them, but it's going to be a defining moment for this country and the world. And I hope that everyone can step up and do their part.
Most college graduates remember their graduation. For this senior class, how are you going to make it up?
Well, we hope to do something which is virtual and make it as engaging as possible, but most universities are having to cancel any kind of physical commencement. Hopefully, you know, we'll be able to work with them to make it memorable, but of course it's a disappointment. This is a time-honored tradition. You were our commencement speaker and HD recipient in 2004. You know how important those events are. We will try to do our best to make it meaningful for our students and their families.
President Monaco, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure, Walter.
Disappointing, surely, but surely they will also never forget pitching in when their country and their world most needed them. And finally, we want to remember Alberto Uderzo. He is the famous illustrator of the world-renowned Asterix and Obelix comics. He died today, age 92, not of coronavirus, but he's been an inspiration since 1959. The books have been translated into more than 100 languages. It was set in the era of Julius Caesar, and the story follows the adventures of heroic Gauls, now known as France, Asterix and Obelix, who hold out against Roman invaders to protect their village. Of course, it's a story about courage and resistance, one that we can conjure up today as we fight our own invasive predator to protect our own villages and communities around the world. And that's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching. Goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.